This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we're checking in with employment law expert Jennifer Shaw on navigating unemployment benefits months into this pandemic. And we'll get something of a history lesson from Chico State Professor Emeritus Steve Bryden on why the United States was able to create a concerted effort to unify during World War II, but is so much more divided when it comes to the invisible enemy we're facing today. If you have questions for us, let us know on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. From Monday, June 22nd, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, the news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. The COVID-19 pandemic is spreading across the North State with new speed, as nearly 100 new cases have been identified since Thursday. The region's caseload is nearing 500. Two counties, Butte and Sutter, have now identified more than 100 people suffering from the ailment. At least 13 people are currently hospitalized. 10 have died. As of Monday afternoon, there were 485 cases across the 11-county region. Sutter County is reporting 112, Butte 111, Shasta 81, Tehama 52, Glenn and Yuba counties each report 42. Siskiyou County is reporting 23, Colusa and Lassen 7 each, Plumas County 6, and Trinity County 2. The daily number of new infections statewide rose sharply Sunday as the California Department of Public Health announced 173,824 Californians have fallen ill with the coronavirus. The department announced 4,515 new infections. Daily figures have been generally around 3,000. Infections are rising by 19.3% per week. Meanwhile, according to the department's data, the number of patients needing hospitalization or intensive care has remained more or less stable. Fatalities in the Golden State reached 5,495, up 10% from a week ago. The department attributed 506 deaths in California over the past week to the virus. In other news, few concrete details were released, but Governor Gavin Newsom and Democratic state legislative leaders said they'd reached agreement Monday on a revised state budget. In a statement, Newsom lamented hard choices but said the document protects education, health care, emergency response, and the social safety net while remaining balanced. Because of the COVID-19 outbreak and disruptions to the economy, the amount of revenue flowing into state coffers as sales and income taxes has fallen off a cliff. Blistering temperatures across inland Northern California have prompted the National Weather Service to issue a heat advisory for much of the region through 8 p.m. Saturday. Forecasters expect temperatures into the triple digits across the foothills, with valley highs near 110, and for heat to linger overnight. Health officials urge the public to stay hydrated, avoid strenuous outdoor activity, and know that excessive sweating, headache, cramping, weakness, and nausea are often signs of heat stroke. Authorities also caution to pay special attention to small children, the elderly, and pets. Organizers of a rally held Friday in Chico in support of Desmond Phillips, a man killed in an officer-involved shooting in Chico, are asking attendees to get tested for the coronavirus. Organizers say they learned a participant at the rally who had no symptoms at the time and was wearing a mask had later tested positive. And finally, the Chico News and Review announced it will resume publication July 1st. The paper will return to print as a monthly periodical, at least through October. That's according to an announcement by acting editor Jason Cassidy. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. More than 3 million people throughout California are still without a job, despite a drop in the state unemployment rate, and many are waiting on unemployment benefits or are having a hard time navigating how to receive them. So today we're going to hear from employment law expert and president of Shaw Law Group, Jennifer Shaw, who recently spoke with CAP Radio's host of Insight, Beth Rujak. The first thing Beth asked was for Shaw to tell her how the pipeline is flowing and if there are a lot of people waiting and feeling stuck right now.
Well, that is a great question. And I can report that at least some people are getting their benefits a lot more quickly than they were the last time we spoke. So there certainly has been an effort by the Employment Development Department to speed things up, to streamline their processes, and to make things a little more understandable to folks when they apply so they get it right the first time. So I am definitely hearing anecdotally that people are getting responses. What I think is still confusing to people is that there really are two systems of unemployment right now in California. There's the regular unemployment insurance program, and then there's the pandemic unemployment assurance or assistance program. And what's confusing to folks is that you apply for the benefits at the same website, but the pandemic benefits are only available to folks if they have a job loss or a wage loss because of COVID. And remember, those are the benefits that apply to the independent contractors and the self-employed and those folks. So one of the things that I think is still causing confusion for folks is they go on the EDD's website, they apply for benefits, and you have to explain what benefit you're applying for. If you get it wrong, it just delays the process. So a lot of what is going on right now is the EDD is trying to help people be sure they're applying for the right benefits so they can process a little more quickly.
Let's say someone has applied for benefits and received the letter or the email that says, yes, you've been approved. Let's talk about the next step, which is certifying. And what do you do if the EDD website doesn't give you the option to certify?
Well, this is what's interesting. The EDD's website says that you're supposed to certify every 2 weeks that you are not working, or you at least have to reveal what wages or compensation you've received during that time period. And there are different rules if you're unemployed or you're a gig worker than if you were a regular employee. So some people are not able to certify because the EDD says, look, we're just going to assume that you didn't have any income. And from what I'm hearing, the EDD is processing those applications, even if people are not certifying. The reason there's no way to certify online is that the EDD doesn't need that particular individual to certify. Now, I will say there are folks who have then received denial letters because they have failed to certify, and they have to go into the Ask EDD sort of prompt on the website, and they pose their question and say, listen, I wasn't able to certify. I was later denied benefits. I need to understand what's going on. It's taking a couple of weeks for people to hear back from those Ask EDD questions, but they are getting responses.
And that speaks to the fact that you're in the system, that checks haven't started coming yet. There can be a lag. Once the state checks start coming, there is even a gap then if you're going to receive the federal money for those checks to come, correct?
There can be. And let's just clarify for folks, because we talk about checks, but really what's happening in California is you get a debit card.
So there'll
be a card that comes, and then benefits are loaded on the card. And those are going to be both the state benefits and the federal benefits. But Beth, you're right. There is a delay sometimes, not always, but there is a delay between when someone is approved. There is state money loaded onto their card, and then the $600 a week federal money comes. The good news is it is retroactive, so they will get that money. But there is sometimes a delay. Now, having said that, I just spoke with an employee this morning who I've been trying to assist through their employer. And she said it was a 2-week process and she got both the federal benefit and the state benefit immediately, at the same time on her debit card. So I do think that if anyone has anything unusual going on, for example, they worked as an independent contractor, then maybe in January of this year, they were made an employee. Now the EDD has to go back and say, all right, did you have enough time in as an employee to be entitled to regular benefits? If you didn't, we're going to put you in the pandemic pile. And that takes some time. So if anybody has anything unusual, it is still taking a while to get those situations handled. I will say that I'm very pleased that the EDD is now processing those requests to Ask EDD. They have been inundated, as you can imagine, with almost 28% unemployment. Well, and the numbers are even showing greater at this point. But they are starting to respond to those, which is good news.
I'm glad you said card, because it's also the alert that that card can seem like offers you get in the mail, the kind of mail that you just throw away. You tear the envelope in half, you toss it in the garbage.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Well, and part of this, I feel like, Beth, that we could be doing a much better job at is PR, right? Letting the public know and how this really works. And that's why I'm so grateful for what you're doing on your show, because people need to understand it's not going to be a big envelope that says, this is your unemployment debit card, please open it. The EDD is understandably worried about theft. So just like when you get a regular debit card in the mail, this is going to be a plain white envelope for most people. And it's very common for people to throw them away, contact the EDD, I haven't received my card, and then the EDD will reissue a card. The problem is that takes a lot of time. So one of the things that I've been telling folks to be really careful about is take your time as you're processing. I know it's frustrating. Make sure you're dotting your I's and you're crossing your T's, so that you can eliminate as much as you can that back and forth.
So as the economy reopens, Jennifer, can someone who doesn't feel safe going back to work continue to receive unemployment benefits?
Probably not, but we have to clarify doesn't feel safe. So part of the situation that we have to remember is there are a lot of new benefits available to employees who need to be home to take care of an ill family member, or who can't go to work because their children can't go to school, or the daycare provider is not open back up again. As the economy begins opening, we have more schools opening, we have daycare providers, we have summer programs, those sorts of things. And as the sort of understanding of what these rights are becomes a little more clear, folks have to understand that if you're just saying, I don't want to go to work because I'm nervous, I don't have any specific concern. It's not like I think my employer is doing something wrong, or I think there's some specific risk to me at work. I just generally don't want to go. Those folks are not going to get unemployment. And there's even a provision in the Pandemic Unemployment Act that says you can be put on what's called a penalty week if you provide false information, or you are not clear about the reason you think you are eligible for those benefits. So people need to be very careful to be honest about, look, I'm just having anxiety. Now, if they have documented medical anxiety about going back to work, that may very well be a legitimate reason for them to get unemployment. But many employees have the misunderstanding that if they just would prefer not to go back to work, that they can somehow keep getting those benefits. And it really is a situation where the unemployment, both the regular and the PUA unemployment, are intended for people who are out of work through no fault of their own.
Here we are in June, by the way. How did that happen? I can't be the only one that feels that way.
I know, I can't believe it either. I just think not only are we in June, we're almost done with June.
Yeah. So there's a retroactive aspect to benefits, and yet the calendar pages keep going by. So how far back is retroactive at this point?
Well, that depends on when the person actually lost their job. Are they applying for regular unemployment? Are they applying for the PUA unemployment? So in other words, if they lost their job, or their hours are reduced, or their pay is reduced because of the pandemic, they're going to be covered under PUA. If they just lost their job because the company said, look, this is a great time for us to restructure, we're going to lay a bunch of people off, then it's not related to COVID and it'll be a regular UI claim. They can generally go back to early February. And the EDD is making good on that. They are issuing a lot of retroactive funds and deposits to these cards for people who applied. And even if they didn't apply on time, if you will, they didn't apply when it first happened, they didn't understand the benefits, so they went ahead and they waited and they applied later, they are also getting retroactive payments. It's just taking some time. Now, the really interesting thing, of course, is we only have a little more than a month, 6 weeks or so, until the $600 a week is going to run out. And that payment, that benefit has been such a huge lifeline for so many people. I know Congress is talking about extending the deadline. We don't have anything firm at this point. There is definitely some partisanship going on back in Congress, not surprisingly, about how much of a benefit they actually want to give. But it's going to be interesting because with that $600 a week, some people have actually been able to bridge the gap in terms of rent, food, that sort of thing. Right. Without that $600, that is a huge cut in resources.
That was employment law expert and president of Shaw Law Group, Jennifer Shaw, speaking with CAP Radio's host of Insight, Beth Rujak. You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. Stay tuned. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Nameless, faceless, it cannot be seen, smelled, or touched. In a matter of months, the coronavirus has killed 120,000 people in the United States, according to the CDC. More than a quarter of the U.S. military casualties in World War II. While the metaphor is not great, like it or not, the United States and the world are at war. But unlike 8 decades ago, when every facet of life was reorganized from above for the war effort, men marching off to join the troops, women to join assembly lines, turning ore and scrap into weaponry. Today, there seems to be more division than concerted effort to beat our invisible enemy. For something of a history lesson on how a vast information or a propaganda campaign unified a fractious nation for a single purpose, a great contrast with today, NSPR's Mark Albert spoke with Steve Bryden, an emeritus professor of history at Chico State and author of the upcoming book, War Stories, How Propaganda Takes America to War. Here's their conversation.
I want to play you an excerpt from a film that I think a lot of people are familiar with called Why We Fight. It was directed by Frank Capra of It's a Wonderful Life fame. And this was, he was recruited by the government to produce this film to explain America's involvement in the war and why it was so important. And as we listen to it, I just want to draw your attention to the language of unity and the language of sacrifice and responsibility, and contrast that with today when the first word out of a lot of people's mouths are liberty and freedom.
They were deadly serious. They were out for world conquest. And what made it doubly serious was that there were 70 million Japanese, 45 million Italians, and 80 million Germans, all hopped up with the same idea. Their leaders told them that they were supermen. Herrenfrau, the Nazis called it. The master race, destined to rule all other peoples on Earth.
Well, let me just comment on the Capra films. In any event, it's Bill Moyers did a really interesting interview with both Frank Capra and then his counterpart from Germany. And the interesting thing was what Capra realized, he got access through a variety of methods to the German propaganda films, and he was impressed.
These were like the Leni Riefenstahl.
Right. And he goes, wow, this is really powerful stuff. What am I going to do? And then he hit upon the idea that instead of making his own, shooting his own films, he would use their stuff. And you could hear in the clip you played the quote, you know, the sound from Hitler's rallies and so on. So what he did is he used their own stuff against them. And it was kind of a brilliant case of turning around the argument. The first one of the Why We Fight really talks about America. You know, we were at home, we were living our normal lives, and then this happens. And so I think that, you know, Capra was, he was a great filmmaker, brilliant, brilliant man. And he really was in touch with the average Joe who went to the movies. And he targeted the fact that, look at what these people are saying. Look at what they're trying to do to us. And he let them speak for themselves. And it really highlighted it. And I think that was more effective. Sometimes you see propaganda films that are so poorly done and so blatant as propaganda that they don't work. But I think Capra generally is considered to have produced probably among the best propaganda ever. The other point he made in his interview with Bill Moyers, which I thought was really interesting, is he said, you know, the thing about Hitler was he looked a little like Charlie Chaplin. In fact, Charlie Chaplin made a movie making fun of Hitler, calling the Great Dictator. And he said, you know, if he wasn't such a terrible man, he would have been a comical figure. And so they were able to use that as well, kind of belittle the man. So he was very, very effective in that. And I think that he was unifying, he was reinforcing a nation that had already started to unify, but these were originally designed for the troops, but eventually were distributed widely. And you know, of course, people went to movies all the time. That was one of the, you didn't have TV in those days, and movies were very important.
Where does this leave us today? I mean, it seems like the nation is completely divided over the course of action. You have people adamant about how restrictions or attempts to defeat or battle this virus by taking personal responsibility is a personal affront or a conspiracy and a violation of freedoms and rights in the Constitution, when, you know, this people have come together in the past and looked at the common need and subsumed their own wishes for the greater good.
It's really a strange world we live in. I used to teach a class on public opinion and propaganda, and we talked about how the media have evolved over time. In the early part of the Republic, they were very partisan. They were controlled by the various parties. And then we eventually got to the point which I think most people consider sort of the golden age, where the effort was to be objective. And, you know, to its credit, I think NPR and PBS have continued that tradition very nicely. But so many people have now found that the money to be made is to segment the audience. So you have CNN and Fox News and MSNBC and so on and so forth, all carving out their own little segment of the population. So if you only listen to MSNBC, you would think Trump was the Antichrist, you know? And if you only listen to Fox News, you probably think just the reverse. And so there's really very few places people can go to get a full range of perspectives. And then you combine that with the fact that as a psychological phenomenon, sometimes called cognitive dissonance theory, we tend to seek out information that reinforces what we already believe, and to discount or ignore information that contradicts it. So the problem is, in our current media environment, and when you throw in social media as well, it's very, very difficult for anybody to get through the clutter and to get through the strong preconceptions of both sides. And what's missing today, I think, is any kind of consensus. And you look at the statistics on, do you worry about reopening the country too fast? They divide on political lines. You look at statistics about, you know, almost any question. I mean, a president's approval ratings have pretty much been in the 40s the whole time, low 40s, high 40s, whatever, but not really moved very much. And, you know, I remember when George W. Bush was elected president, and in a very controversial election, and after 9/11, I mean, the nation rallied around him and he worked hard to bring the nation together. Eventually that fell apart, but that's another story. But I think that one of the things I don't understand, and you know, it's, I'm not an expert on why he would do this, but I don't understand why the president, when he became president, did not reach out at the very beginning with a call for unity, because that's what is needed, especially in an election that was so close. So I don't understand that. Doesn't mean he would have succeeded, but he would have at least made that effort. And I maybe I'm missing something, but I never heard that call for bring us together.
Dr. Bryden, I'm out of questions. I'm wondering if there's what else you'd like to add, and what good questions I should have asked and haven't.
Well, I mean, I think that here's the thing that I think we need to be careful about. We use war as a metaphor for almost anything you can think of, the war on drugs, the war on poverty, whatever. But a real war against a real enemy that's shooting at us is very different than fighting an invisible virus or a social problem like drugs or poverty or something like that. And I think that there's a danger of letting the metaphor capture us, and then we start thinking about, well, how can we fight this like it's a war? And it's not a war in that sense. And I think that the notion of, well, in fact, Governor Inslee made a great statement when he first started imposing some restrictions in Washington state. And he said, people say, what's the penalty going to be if I violate these? And he said, the penalty is going to be you might kill grandpa. And I think what we have missed in this, take wearing a mask as a case in point, is that, you know, the masks that the average person's wearing don't protect them. You can't, you know, you're not supposed to be wearing an N95 mask. You can't buy them if you wanted to, right? The mask you're wearing is to protect the person you're standing next to, so that if you do cough or sneeze or something, they're not affected. And I think the notion of you're doing this not for you, you're doing it for your grandpa and your grandma and the person down the street who's got taking chemotherapy and can't afford to get sick and so on. I think that needs to be the message, that you're doing it for others. And, you know, we're not hearing that enough, I don't think.
That was Steve Bryden, Emeritus Professor of History at Chico State, speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. And that is your program. As always, if you have any thoughts for us, leave them on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, Angel Haracha, Eric Radaville, Kylo Castilla, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Today's episode was mixed by Cam Ford. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.